case on this morning's call is number 02-2130, Michael B. Smith against Labs. Ms. Carrick.
Good morning. The motion for summary judgment must be denied as a matter of law for three independent reasons. First, the defendants failed to submit admissible evidence to refute all of the material elements in the case. Two, the ultimate resolution of the facts will require the jury to determine the credibility of defendant policeman Lamb. And three, under the Seventh Circuit's case of Ianco versus Chicago, the district court must engage in a fact-intensive examination when the policeman is the complaining witness and he's also claiming absolute immunity. Court has suggested this cannot be done on summary judgment. In this case, when defendants filed their motion for summary judgment, they already knew to an absolute certainty that there was major controversy on at least three facts material to this case. They had attended the deposition of the assistant state's attorney, Mary Lennon Nader. With her transcript in hand, they could not possibly have been in good faith when they filed defendant Lamb's affidavit as purported indisputable fact. We wrote they were deliberately attempting to mislead the court to believe there was no controversy on the issue. Instead of referring the court to Nader's deposition to see what the state's attorney had
to say.
What would
Officer Lamb's had understood to have probable cause to make the arrest in the first
place? Pardon me?
What would he have had to take into consideration to support a probable cause arrest?
Yes, it's an objective standard, but the jury would have to determine his credibility on what he knew at the time of the arrest. And specifically, I would ask, what would the jury know, think about the fact that he had already written a memo to himself where the village attorney had specifically told him that these activities by the solicitors do not constitute the specific crime of impersonation of a peace officer, and they don't so much as constitute an ordinance violation. He would also be called.
Now, when does he have to know that?
At the time of the arrest, they would also want to know what he knew about the two dental employees. You cannot tell from their statements what he questioned them on. You cannot determine from just reading what's in the file whether he realized that Karen Jurizek had no firsthand information, which she later clarifies. So the issue becomes, did he have probable cause? And you'll notice in our brief, we referred you to cases where the court said that there isn't probable cause if there's no evidence that a crime itself has been committed. You'll notice that neither of the two witnesses said that he was a police officer. He said, I'm from the police department, and 1 minute later, the police were there. They may have been outside. They were there immediately, and within 7 minutes.
Was he from the police department?
No, he was from the police union solicitor. He represented the police.
But they said he said he was from the police department.
Yes.
Okay.
If you look at the statute for false personation of a peace officer, it is very explicit that one has to knowingly represent himself to be a peace officer of a jurisdiction. And if you look at this case, it simply does not meet the criteria, and that was the opinion of the village attorney as well. They had, and he, by the way, this man was not.
Well, but that would be for a conviction, right? The question is, what about probable cause?
No, she said it didn't meet the elements, period, because one has to claim to be a peace officer. He never said that he was a policeman, and in fact, some of the records show they have all sorts of telephone.
Well, that's an opinion. That's an opinion of the lady who declined to prosecute, but that doesn't make it absolute, does it?
No, the village attorney refused to prosecute.
I know, but that's an interesting observation, but it has nothing to do with whether or not the officer had probable cause when he made the arrest.
Yes, it does, because he already had been over these facts. They had been receiving phone calls throughout the village for 2 years. He had documented 2 years of an investigation, including turning the evidence of other calls that were like this one over to the village attorney, asking her to prosecute. She declined because she said it does not meet the elements, specifically a false personation of a police officer, and it doesn't even.
How about theft by deception?
It's not theft by deception because the checks were made out for a legitimate purpose, and they were made out for that purpose. And there's no evidence on that in the record whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, when the state's attorney had her deposition taken, she said that she would have never charged Mr. Smith with attempted theft by deception because the elements of the crime simply were not there. You'll also see that Mr. Smith claims that the state's attorney, Mary Nader, approved the charge and that that was somehow his excuse why it was okay to make the arrest sort of a retroactive. But when she was deposed, she completely contradicted what Mr. Lambs had said. She said it wasn't even her job at the state's attorney to approve such charges, and she named some other lawyer.
Was there a grand jury convened in this case?
Yes, there's a grand jury transcript in the record where Officer Lambs was the complaining witness, and he testified that Algonquin had conducted a huge investigation for 2 years of the solicitors and had never been able to get an arrest because they couldn't identify one until Mr. Smith.
Did the jury, grand jury, return an indictment?
Yes, they did, and that transcript is in the record. If I may go on. This incident of giving us the motion for summary judgment was the fifth in a series of incidents below where the defendants would file documents, and once we responded, they would file no replies whatsoever. This had happened on at least two motions where we had briefed the issues. The court in one actually called the lawyers and instructed them to file a brief, but they did not do so. They had failed to attend court, and we finally had to get a motion to compel depositions. So by the time we got to this motion for summary judgment, we wanted to focus the court's attention on the issue that there was insufficient evidence to support summary judgment on each element. And defendant Lambs's credibility is an issue as to what the jury would think that he had in his head the day he arrested Mr. Smith from his conference with the village attorney who had told him that it did not constitute a crime. The advisory committee notes to Rule 56 direct that summary judgment must be denied when material issues turn on the credibility of the witness. And the Seventh Circuit has also held that when credibility, motive, or intent is an issue, the jury must be allowed to hear him cross-examined.
Now, is there any dispute as to what the two dental people told the officer?
Yes, there is. If you read the first statement, which
material dispute.
Yes, there is a material dispute. The first statement of Karen Jurczak says what Smith purportedly said when he went to that office. But when their statements, which are in the state's attorney's file, which came up during the criminal prosecution, she was asked more thorough questions, and it turned out that this is what the other lady had told her. She said she never saw Smith, she never heard Smith, and she never identified Smith as the man on the telephone. And in fact, his pleading states he's not the solicitor, he was a collection agent. And I was going to suggest that the Seventh Circuit has specifically adopted the advisory rules for 56 concerning credibility, motive, or intent, where the jury should hear the person cross-examined, and he should not be allowed to escape cross-examination by proffering an affidavit in support of summary judgment. And that's Conrad versus Delta Airlines and Wang versus Lake Maxenhall. The court erred as a matter of law when it allowed Lambs to withdraw from cross-examination. And second, with the motion only supported by Lambs's hearsay affidavit of what he said, the state's attorney said, and the first two statements of the dental employees, the court erred as a matter of law on a second basis, finding there was no genuine issue as to any material fact. There was simply not admissible evidence in the record on every material issue. The Seventh Circuit has also adopted the advisory committee notes on Rule 56, second principle, when it ruled that summary judgment must be denied if the evidence filed by the moving party was not sufficient and even if no opposing evidence were filed, and that's Thornton versus Evans. Alternatively, the court abused its discretion in failing to consider any evidence we filed. The defendants have not cited even one case under Local Rule 56.1 where a court simply defaulted the party who filed a defective response. In every case cited, the district court made a finding that the party making the motion had filed an objection or had filed a motion to strike the defective response or the respondent failed to request an opportunity to cure the defect. We had none of those opportunities, and we have found no case where a court refused to consider the evidence filed by the respondent when their brief did contain page references to the transcript, as ours did. Given all of the history of this case, in the district court, we submit that the court did abuse its discretion. It did not have to wade through anything. It should have been clear to the court that there was insufficient admissible evidence proffered to support the summary judgment. It should have been clear that because matters were contested, it would turn on the credibility of witnesses. The bottom line was they filed the motion. They knew to a certainty the facts were controverted, and for that reason, they simply did not reply once we filed our response. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carrick. We'll hear now from Mr. DeConcini. DeConcini, I'm sorry.
Good morning. May it please the court, Thomas G. DeConcini on behalf of the defendants. I had a law school professor who used to say, have this adage, when the law is against you, hammer the facts. When the facts are against you, hammer the law. When they're both against you, hammer the table. There's a fourth that's been added by this case, hammer opposing counsel. The plaintiff's case in here failed procedurally, it failed factually, and it failed legally. And what they've been reduced to is ad hominem attacks on me to support their case. Let me talk first about the procedural failures in their case. They didn't file a Rule 56 response to our Rule 56 statement. It's not that they had technical deficiencies in the Rule 56 statement. They didn't file one. The court then deemed everything that was in our Rule 56 statement as admitted and as true.
Were they given any opportunity to cure the
they were not. They were not given an opportunity to cure. But the court did not default them, or I guess in that case it would be dismiss it for prosecution. The court didn't do that. The court looked at the facts. Mm-hmm. And the court examined what we had provided and made a decision on the merits. It wasn't any type of a default. Their argument here today is, well, they only filed it in that fashion because they wanted to show our bad faith. But first I think you have to win the motion for summary judgment, defeat the summary judgment, then you can try to show bad faith. And there's also all these provisions, these safe harbor provisions under Rule 11, where if you think there's bad faith, you can do all that. The judge interpreted it as admissions, and there was no abuse of discretion in its doing so. Now, let me talk about factually why their case fails. First of all, counsel said to you that we have to show that all the elements are not there to get summary judgment. We only have to show that one of the elements is not there to get summary judgment. And I don't think this court is going to see too many cases where probable cause is more clear than in this case. You had written statements by the witnesses in their own hand. These aren't summaries by a police officer. It's not something that appears in a report. They wrote out these statements and signed the statements and gave them to the arresting officer, Detective Lambs, at the scene of the arrest. And it was based on those statements that Detective Lambs made the arrests. How much clearer can you get to have probable cause? Now, counsel has kept bringing up this whole business about the village attorney saying there's no cause of action, there's no criminal statement. In August, the arrest was in January of 1998. In August of 1997, the village had received a series of complaints from inquiries from citizens in the village of Algonquin about solicitations from the police union. Was it proper? Should they be doing this? Should they be calling? And whatnot. And there were certain, there was an investigation conducted, and certain cases were targeted. They were able to focus on a few of the cases, and they went to the village attorney and said, are these prosecutable cases? And the village attorney said no. So they dropped it at that point. That had nothing to do with Michael Smith, okay? That had nothing to do with Michael Smith's facts. The facts in this case had nothing to do with what happened in August of 1997, with the exception that they all involved police solicitations. Case here was based on was, and this is not disputed, what was based on was two dental office employees who gave written statements saying that Michael Smith, the plaintiff, walked into the dental office and said, I am from the Algonquin Police Department. And based on that, an arrest was made. Now, the statute is false impersonation of a police officer. Did he say, I'm an Algonquin police officer? No. Did he mean to convey the belief that he was an Algonquin police officer? Unquestionably. And if nothing else shows you that, it's that the reason the Algonquin police were notified here was that first they solicited by telephone the $150 contribution, and the secretary in the office agreed to it. Then when the dentist came back from lunch or wherever he was, he said, no, I don't want to do that, I give enough, or something like that. They called the Algonquin Police Department, and they said, cancel that contribution, we're not going to do it. And that's when Lambs got involved, and Lambs said, what are you talking about? And they said, well, one of your guys just called us and said they're going to get come by and pick up a $150 contribution, and we want to cancel it. And Lamb says, well, our guys don't do that. That's not proper. Listen, when this fellow shows up, would you please delay him so we can come by and talk to him? Well, that's exactly what they did. And when this fellow walked in, who happened to be Michael Smith, he walks up to the two secretaries in the dental office, and he says, I'm from the Algonquin Police Department. And they wrote that down in their factual statements to Smith. Smith questioned, the plaintiff at the scene. He questioned the two dental associates or secretaries. He asked them if they put it in writing. They put it in writing. He made the arrest based on all that. What else can he do? He has no reason to doubt that they have any kind of a reason to be making this up or to not be accurate. He based his probable cause on the statements they gave him. Now, they talk about the assistant state's attorney, Mary Lennon. She gave a deposition several years after the incident, and the officer at the time of the arrest put in his report, assistant state's attorney Mary Lennon said, approved the prosecution and even suggested attempt theft. Now, at her deposition, she said, I don't remember doing that. Doesn't sound like something I would do. But she very specifically said, I'm not ruling out that I did it. I'm just telling you I have no memory of it, and it doesn't sound like something I would do. That's all she said. So she doesn't say anything that makes Lambs into a liar. She doesn't say anything that even questions Lambs' testimony. And he put it right in his statement on the day of the arrest. What did he do, pick a name out of the air to put it in? And let's just put it in aside for a second. That wouldn't negate probable cause anyway. Even if she said, there's no way on earth that I said that. I remember that day perfectly, and there's no way on earth I approved that. That wouldn't negate probable cause. It may call Lambs' credibility into question. But we have probable cause in this case based on written statements by independent witnesses. I don't care what Lambs' credibility is. There seems to be here to be no question that there's probable cause, regardless of what the state's attorney said. Now, for the first time here, and for the first time in the reply brief, they're telling the court that the facts that are set forth in the written statements by the two witnesses don't qualify as crimes under the Illinois statute, the false personation statute. And first of all, let me address the question about they had an investigator go in afterward and take statements when the prosecution was ongoing from these two employees of the dental office. And each of them said something like, well, I don't remember if that's what I said or not. And when they showed their statements, they said something along the lines of, maybe that happened, maybe that didn't happen. I don't really recall. I think at that point they probably didn't want to be involved in this anymore. But nevertheless, they didn't say I was coerced into making those statements. They didn't say Lambs told me what to say. They didn't say that anything that would have called into question those earlier written statements that they gave. So this whole business about the statements having been repudiated or something, it's just not supported by the record. But based on I submit to you clearly that what the written statements say that Mr. Smith did, where he goes in and says, I'm from the Algonquin Police Department, clearly is impersonating the police officer. He's not from the Algonquin Police Department. He's not even from the police union. He is from a company, a solicitation company, that's hired by the union to solicit. And in fact, that's not even the local. That's the overall union, the Metropolitan Alliance of Police. So it's not even the local chapter that represents Algonquin. It's the larger organization.
Were the cards in his possession found after the arrest?
Yes, they were. Yes, they were. They were found after the arrest was made. So we didn't. We put them in as background information. But nevertheless, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say that it's a close question on whether or not that's impersonating the police officer. First of all, it was presented to the grand jury, and the grand jury thought it was impersonating the police officer. So I think right there that breaks any chain of causation that might be raised if there was a question about it. But then again, then at that point, qualified immunity would kick in my view, because it certainly has not been clearly established anywhere that this type of conduct could not give rise to a charge of impersonation of a police officer. So factually, they have no case, respectfully. Now, legally, I didn't talk about it here, but legally I'll spend a minute on it. There was some discussion in their reply brief specifically about how we misinterpreted Newsom or how we are telling the court what Newsom was all about. Clearly, the law, I think, is somewhat in development right now among you. As to what is malicious prosecution under Section 1983, what isn't, how far does a police officer have to go to be responsible for post-arrest prosecutions and whatnot. The Jones case and there's a couple of recent cases talk about this is more likely a due process type claim for interference with prosecution or trumping up evidence during the course of prosecution. And I understand fully that Newsom has raised some serious questions about the nature of the law in this respect. None of those apply here. None of those apply here because the only action taken by Lambs in this case was at the point of the arrest. So probable cause is a perfect defense, I submit to you, for any claim that the plaintiff could make here. And there isn't any question that there was probable cause. I submit to the court that you will not see, and there's much hyperbole in this statement, but I don't think that you will see a great deal of cases where probable cause is the issue, where it's as clear as it is here, where it's not a question of anybody's credibility. The probable cause was based on witness statements written by the witnesses, signed by the witnesses, later presented to a grand jury and used to support a true bill by the grand jury. So if there's no other questions, I will ask the court for affirmance of Judge Reinhardt's summary judgment.
Thank you, Mr. DeCiani. Ms. Carrick, you have some time for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to first address the question that you asked. Not only were we not permitted to cure, but when he says that the court considered the evidence, the court only considered his evidence. It specifically refused to refer to ours. And we also submit that their evidence is not admissible. You raised the question as to what the prior investigation was. If you look in the appendix around page A147, you will find that in August, before the arrest in January, Officer Lambs himself wrote reports that were captioned impersonation of a police officer, where he wrote numerous phone calls from people who had received calls saying, I'm either a police officer or I'm from the police department. But based on that group of reports, he had given those to the village attorney. Her firm had reviewed them and said this does not constitute the crime. So there was no probable cause. He already knew specifically that calling up a person to get a solicitation for a legitimate book did not constitute the crime. And yet,
what if you say you're from the police department?
That's what all of the callers had said in August and September when he wrote all of the reports and gave it to the village attorney to say, let's go prosecute these.
Any indication where an individual walks up to someone face-to-face and says, I'm from the Algonquin Police Department?
Well, they had been collecting for this book, yes. And you can read that in the reports where people called. Some were complaining about the solicitations, but others actually gave contributions, and those, and it was a legitimate operation for the police union. But my point is, he already knew that. He knew that they were claiming to be police officers, from the police department, and the village attorney had said, this is not the crime. So what does he do? Within a minute, he's over to the dental office to arrest somebody for exactly that crime.
Why do you suppose they called the police department to ask to tell him not to come out?
Someone had called, not Smith, had called, and the dental office had committed to a $150 contribution.
Why do you suppose they called the police department?
The dentist said that he did not want to do it, so she called the police.
Well, why would you call the police department if you knew it was somebody not connected with the police?
No. The dentist said that he didn't want to make a contribution, so his secretary called the police department to cancel the contribution.
I understand.
And at that point, they said, hold whoever shows up. And that's how they got to Smith.
Why do you suppose the witness called the police department instead of the solicitor?
Because she was making a gift for the police union. And I believe that all of the police, or a majority of the police, belong to the union. So she called the department to cancel the gift. I have one other issue I'd like to make.
So you call the police department, right?
She did. And that's
to talk to a police officer.
She actually talked to a dispatcher who is not a police officer.
Well, that's a very technical difference, isn't it? She called the police dispatcher instead of talking to an officer.
I was trying to answer you precisely. Okay? But we also have to deal with what the crime is and the fact that he had been studying it for 4 months and the fact that he already knew it wasn't that crime, but he wanted to arrest him for a felony anyway. And that is why the policeman needs some governor. I'd like to give you a couple of examples of how, on this appeal, the defendants have continued with their same tactics. Page 6 of their brief says that even if the court were to consider our evidence, they are entitled to summary judgment because, quote, the only evidence submitted by plaintiff was inadmissible hearsay. But we had 3 sworn transcripts and party admissions in the file. They went on to say that they had filed depositions, affidavits, and pleadings at page 11, but that was also not true. If you look at Local Rule 56.1, it does not tell you how you object to a bad faith pleading, but it anticipates a remedy at 56G. In your case of Melrose versus Shearson, court fees were awarded when the motion for summary judgment was not well grounded in fact and was simply to harass. The court said that the plaintiff had a duty to mitigate by getting to the issues quickly and efficiently. That's what we tried to do. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Carrick. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel.